Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this, welcome to the Film Realist Podcast, the film and TV podcast from a complete nobody. That is hopefully for somebody. My name is Kyle Naranya, and welcome to episode 209, where I am going to be reviewing Supergirl, my most anticipated movie of the year. Now, there's a lot of detractors who want to say that wasn't my most anticipated movie of the year. You just have to go and look at the list that I released in January. So obviously, I am incredibly excited to be talking about this movie today. Because it's a feature film review, there will be a brief non-spoiler section, as well as a spoiler section for those of us who have seen the film. And if you want to hop around, time codes will be listed in the description. And then we'll end the episode with my favorite entertainment news of the week and responding to question of the week responses and listener mail. Now, I guess let's go get drunk in space with Kara Zor-El. Let's dive into Supergirl.
Do you have any information on the brigands?
That sort of information is going to cost you.
I'll tell you what. I'll arm wrestle you for her. Seriously, you win and you can have us both. I win. And you can tell us where the brigands are.
Obviously, my expectations were incredibly high, given the fact that this was my most anticipated movie of the year. And with that comes a very high bar to reach. But what's unfortunately happened, and this should have been assumed leading into the release of Supergirl, it is a female-led superhero film. And if you're unaware, there's always been a conversation over, I would say, hyper-criticism when it is a female lead, and the conversation around the critical consensus, which of course, Rotten Tomatoes has become so important to the marketing of a film. It's certified fresh, or they use the audience score instead of the critics one to show that either audiences are right and critics are wrong, or vice versa. And that to me is incredibly frustrating, because what seems to have happened in the last, I would say, handful of years is films that used to get passes, and I'm not saying that this is Supergirl is lesser because of this. I'm actually saying the opposite. Things would get accepted or put through positively because of what they happen to be around. There are several MCU movies, just for the sake of argument, that have higher Rotten Tomatoes consensus, which is, if you don't know, an amalgamation of reviews positively or negatively that wind up being that percentage. This percentage of critics reviewed this movie positively. The fact that Thor the Dark World, Thor Love and Thunder, as well as Black Widow have higher review percentages, I find incredibly hilarious. Not to mention on the DC side, we have Wonder Woman 1984, The Flash, both have higher Rotten Tomatoes percentages. And that, unfortunately, has become a part of the conversation. It's really annoying to see what criticisms have been levied towards the film, when for so long it seemed like leaning into the positives, and minor criticisms are now at the forefront because of wanting to bury films that happen to be slightly different or have a female lead. And it's incredibly frustrating given the excitement around this character. I have read Woman of Tomorrow. I loved Woman of Tomorrow. I like Craig Gillespie, and I love Millie Alcock. She is incredible in House of the Dragon, and one of my biggest criticisms of that first season was changing out the actor who played Rhaenyra. Now it's obviously worked out. Season 3, you can read my review of the first 4 episodes on Multiverse of Color. But let's get to Supergirl, because that's why you're here. I think this movie is very good. It's not great. Millie Alcock is Supergirl. If you enjoyed what we saw from her in that end scene in Superman, that is the appetizer to what this movie is, which is the full entree. And what makes Supergirl more interesting to me than Superman is Superman inherently is not truly an interesting character. It's all of the things that happen around him, given his hope and what he strives for, which is the good in people. And usually it's the craziness and wild situations that happen around Superman that bring him into the fold that make for a compelling story. Look at the way that it was handled so excellently in Superman. Now that movie's far from perfect as well, but Supergirl has a much more interesting history than her cousin Clark. She lived on Krypton. She has experienced loss in a way that so few fictional characters have. She lost her entire planet and then it is assumed because of her cousin that she's just going to move on and adapt his homeworld. And the dichotomy of those two characters does make where this universe goes very compelling because they are such different people. And Supergirl sells what makes this DCU version of Kara Zor-El, or Kara, the most interesting version because of what she's willing to do and who she is as a person when we meet her. She has so much baggage and does not want to move on with her life. She is stuck in a depression because of that thing, and her birthday celebration ultimately throws her into this adventure that, you know, she didn't really want to be a part of until something negatively happens to her, which, of course, we see in the trailers, has to do with Krypto. Millie Alcock is stellar in this role because of the source material. This was always going to be an incredible performance in a comic book movie because of the emotional gambit that Millie and Kara, I'm just going to say Kara because that's my brain is just coded for that, goes through. Emotionally, she's already not in a great place, but the journey that she goes through in this film, quite literally becoming Supergirl before our eyes and showing why she is such a special character and why this hero is important to the DCU outside of just being Clark Kent's cousin. This movie's goal, more than anything, is selling Millie Alcock as Supergirl, and that is absolutely achieved. Check the box off. Also, it is a Woman of Tomorrow adaptation. Inspired by, I would say, is much more a loose term. So much of this is adapted from that comic, and there are pros to that as well as cons. The basis of this story is very much built into what was in Woman of Tomorrow, that being Krypto being injured, Kara being on a bender, meeting Ruth, and the villain of the story being Krem. Now, Eve Ridley as Ruth, that performance and being the kid who pulls the adult into the adventure can so often be annoying, antagonistic in a way where you just don't wind up liking that person because they're getting in the way of our main protagonist. But what Eve Ridley is able to do for the most part is really sell someone who is on the precipice of going into the dark places that Kara may be at when the film begins. And having those two characters and having that back and forth be the foundation for the film is excellent. They're able to maintain the relationship that we all fell in love with for those who of us who read the comic. I don't think you need to, and the experience might significantly differ if you haven't read the comic book, but Eve Ridley as Ruth works really well. Unfortunately, and I said this in my trailer reactions as well as the conversations I had on the Multiverse of Color about the trailers, Matthias Schoenaerts, I'm apologizing, I'm probably mispronouncing that. What he's given to do as Krem is the character is made more evil with certain things that he does that I'll explain in full spoilers. The aesthetic of the character ultimately just feels over the top for the sake of visual villainy. The character in the comic is just a generic-looking ginger man, red-headed man, with a goatee and short hair, and it's the villainy and terrible things that he does that make him terrifying. It's not, look at me, I'm evil. There's a subtlety until he has a terrible act and does these heinous things that truly show the darkness and the depths he's willing to go to because of what a terrible person he is. And having the aesthetics of that character completely go against what he does really shows how evil he is. And the switch in the movie is much more about all of those things kind of go hand in hand. And those elements don't work because the character is not in the film a ton. There doesn't seem to be what we've seen so much in comic book films, and I'm glad they didn't do this because of what he ultimately does do in the film, a way of sort of getting us to understand his point of view. This is a bad guy, he's bad. That, in 2026, is not enough depth to a comic book villain. If you just leaned into him being as evil as we know him to be, it would have worked out a lot better. But because of the simplicity from taking the 12 comic issues down into under 2 hours, there's not a lot of room for that character to really sink his teeth into. And he does his best with what he's given, but the character's just evil. And because he looks evil, the shock and understanding of that character just didn't really work for me, which is disappointing because at the end of the day, a hero is only as good as their villain. Now, outside of Krem, we also get to have Jason Momoa as Lobo, a character he believed he was going to be playing when he was cast in Batman v Superman 10 years ago. It's hard to believe that that film is 10 years old already. Jason Momoa was genetically designed in a lab to play Lobo. If you grew up with Superman the Animated Series, when really he came to the forefront of pop culture, as well as all of his other appearances, he was actually in Superman Man of Tomorrow, the direct-to-video Superman origin film in the Tomorrowverse. But Jason Momoa knows exactly what tone this character needs to be. The use of him, of having his own story that tangentially connects to the adventure that we're on, works really effectively. He doesn't steal the movie. He might steal the scenes that he's in, but overall, he's used just the right amount. It sells who this character is, why comic book readers and fans of the animated series, and he's shown up in pretty much everything. He was in Krypton. I don't think he made it to Smallville, but friend of the show Andy Babak will remind me when he eventually hears this. But that character can't be too overwhelming because similar to Eve Ridley's Ruth, he would become annoying. And I don't think that he does. His back and forth with Kara as well as Ruth, his scenes with Ruth might be the best in the movie, but that character really works because he's doing his own thing. It just happens to sort of be involved with what's going on with Kara. And I like that a lot because that character needs to sort of be refreshing in whatever moment he sort of weaves himself into. And what I like about that is I want more of that character. You can't have him in the movie where he's so obnoxiously annoying, or even if he's entertaining and funny, he can't take over the movie. This is Supergirl's movie, and everybody knows that that can't be the case, and they mostly achieve that. My biggest criticism outside of Krem for the film is we're in an era now where you really do have to sell people on the theatrical experience. And unfortunately, one of the major changes from the comic is the visual aesthetic. There has been a criticism that's been levied, and I don't think it's unfair, but the cinematography and the use of color does put this much more in line with other space adventure films we've seen, like Guardians and Mad Max, because of the choice to not fully integrate the surreal nature that you could have had with the cinematography of the movie. The comic book itself is very colorful, and the art on top of the story, it being a visual medium, is what helped sell this comic and make it so beloved. And most of the cinematography to this film is very muddied and gray. And yes, you can argue that it's because Supergirl is the beacon of color, and there are some interesting choices on how to use color in the film, specifically in the third act. You might notice if you're paying attention to the trailers. But if you sold a visual masterpiece where something is almost surreal, it's outside of reality. This is the DC Universe. One of the major factors that separates it from the Marvel Universe, not the films, is the Marvel Comics universe takes place on Earth as we know it. They use real cities. The DC Universe is not. We have our Gotham. We don't have New York. We have Metropolis. Yes, it's in Kansas. They use real states. But the cities are their own. Star City, Central City, and it goes on and on and on. If you really dove into really significant choices with color, and we see opportunities for that. There are some gorgeous shots with the use of sunlight to really sell what Kara needs to be a superhero. It's yellow sunlight. And using her weaknesses and strengths in ways that are really captivating. There's some shots in space that I really, really liked, and getting to see Millie's choices as Kara, how she uses her powers, how she decidingly is holding back against using them, because again, Kryptonians, the most powerful beings that we have within the DC universe, but her experience and Clark's experience, we are shown and sold why she is different and why she is special. There's a lot to get into in non-spoilers, but overall, and I don't love doing this, and listeners will know that, this is a good movie. It sells Supergirl. And at the end of the day, watching Superman and then Supergirl, are you excited of seeing those characters more? We know in the trailers, and I'll get, this is much more, I think, based into the spoiler conversation, but we see Clark and Kara interact, and you need to want to see more of that. And I absolutely did. Something that I'm going to try to do maybe in the next couple weeks is watch Superman and immediately follow with it with Supergirl because of how interconnected those films are. And that experience is something I'm really excited about because Man of Tomorrow is already filming and we know that Supergirl is going to be a part of it. So the springboard moving forward within the Superman saga is, did you like Superman? Did you like Supergirl? Well, good news. We're getting a third film with those characters where things are really going to interconnect in really exciting ways, especially on where Supergirl ends. That will do it for my spoiler thoughts. And now let's jump into the non-spoiler thoughts. Now let's dive into this full spoilers and why some changes were good and some changes were maybe not so great.
Aikalata.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't speak Kryptonian. I wasn't raised there. So I wasn't raised there. Why am I talking louder? Let me help you.
The first place I want to start with spoilers is actually based on the clip you just heard. That's her relationship with Clark, as well as the use of Krypton in the film, because that is one of those elements that is drastically changed from the comic that does improve the overall story. Of course, when Supergirl was released as the comic Woman of Tomorrow, a lot of that universe is already established. In this, we have the second feature film within the DCU, and we need to explain certain things. Obviously, Superman had its opening crawl that established a general idea for the main universe, but this version has to sell what makes Kara different, what is her history with Krypton, because that is one of the major factors that separates Kara from Clark. She actually lived on Krypton and has to deal with losing all of those people. And typically, it is whether she's in suspended animation, trapped in the Phantom Zone. If you're a fan of Smallville, she was in suspended animation under a lake, or for whatever reason, she's frozen floating through space to separate those two characters in ages. And I had some general assumptions they were going to do something like this because typically Kara is older chronologically than Clark, but not actually in terms of how old they are. Usually she is younger, at least in the way that it's presented, because of the delay getting to Earth. It was a brilliant choice to sort of wrap up a bunch of different versions of Supergirl's origin in this film. In Superman the Animated Series, believe it or not, at that point, Superman was only allowed to be the last Kryptonian of the planet. There had been so many prior to the Crisis on Infinite Earths situation in the 80s that when they changed the continuity, they only wanted Clark to be Kal-El, to be the last Kryptonian, nobody else. They had to be from other places. So in Superman the Animated Series, because they wanted to introduce that character, they made her from Argo, a sister planet to the Kryptonians, therefore she would have similar powers, but wasn't technically actually Clark's cousin. They didn't go with that specifically, but what they do here is Zor-El, Kara's father, I'm just going to say Kara because that's what I'm used to at this point, separates Argo City, quite literally bottling it from the planet, and it flies off into its own space, saving the inhabitants of Krypton within that specific pocket. We even see Clark zoom off in his orb or his spaceship from Krypton. And one of the most important lines of dialogue to this whole Superman saga is delivered where we hear Alora say, "That's the baby your brother is sending off to rule the planet Earth." I'm paraphrasing, but this solidifies something that people have continued to argue since the release of Superman, which is that the message was altered and it was AI or something. James Gunn himself has said that's not the case, and that Lara and Jor-El are actually the people that was presented in Superman, and it continues to be the truth here. We know that Zor-El and Allura are different, and obviously view that as some extremism, and we get to see through Argo City's presentation of Kryptonian society and culture how they differ from what we've heard and what we've seen from the other Els in Superman. Kara is eventually born in the Argo City, bottle city, floating in space, from Krypton 8 years later, this explaining the gap in ages, but when the city separated itself from Krypton, during the irradiation of the planet, kryptonite was invented or created, thus slowly infecting all of the crops in the atmosphere, poisoning people. This forces Zor-El and Allura to send her off to Earth just so that she can survive. So in this instance, this is one of the rare circumstances where Kara is biologically and chronologically younger than Clark Kent. What I like about this is it still bakes in all of the reasons for why she is in the midst of depression. She experienced Kryptonian culture and is aware and has memories of losing her parents. She finds Krypto. We saw that in the trailer. It's very cute. But we see somebody truly lose everything. And that's where Kara is emotionally when the film begins. We get to see her meeting Clark. And what this does even more so throughout the DCU, and I would argue this just solidifies my opinion of this, which is David Korenswet is the greatest. No, I shouldn't say that. What he's doing as Superman just continues to emphasize the point that he is perfect for Superman right now. He is going to have another movie with Man of Tomorrow, which ironically we know that Supergirl is going to be a part of it. But it is possible that if he continues this run, that he may become the definitive Superman. I know for Melody and Sawyer, he is their Superman. He was the first live-action Superman they ever saw. And the relationship that Clark has with Kara is even more emphasized because of what we've seen in Superman and the back and forth of somebody who really does not want to embrace this new life. She is running away from moving forward. That's where Kara is emotionally as we see her in the film. And anytime those two characters are in the same scenes together, we see what makes them so different. And that's one of the major selling points of the movie. Selling Millie Alcock's Supergirl as being inherently different than Clark, not just a female version, which in some interpretations, you could regard Kara as just a female Clark. And that's not what's happening here. The other really big change that hurts the film, because it follows a trend that we have seen in so many other female-led films, and I don't understand necessarily why this was added to the film. It has to do with Krem. Krem's aesthetic, I mentioned this in non-spoilers, changed dramatically from what he looks like in the comic. It's much more on the nose that he is a villain, and to overemphasize that, there is a part of the storyline that has to do with human trafficking, and collecting young girls who will eventually become women to be the wives of the brigands so that way they can continue their all-male race. And there's a lot of seriousness into which this story is explored, but every instance that addresses this part of the storyline feels added on, and the fact that this is a trend is something that I don't necessarily understand. Because of what was removed from the comic, this added nature, and every time this comes up within the story of the movie, it just feels tangential. We see a lot of bad things done by Krem. He kills Ruth's family, and he is a space pirate who does what he wants. One of the major factors is he poisons Krypto. He doesn't mortally kill him or injure him like he does in the comic. He gives him a poison, so it creates this ticking time bomb of, we need to get this antidote by a certain point, or Krypto's going to die. It is Kara's only tether to her life on Krypton. Those are enough emotional motivators for our main characters. Anytime we spend with a family that is connected to Krem's trafficking of those people, of those girls, it feels unnecessarily serious. And I know in Screen Rant, there was an article about somebody who brought their 12-year-old daughter and they regretted it. This was not a story element that was regarded at all within the marketing material. And I understand wanting to deliver a villain who is a villain and does bad things. But the fact that this is becoming a trend within female-led superhero films is something just I have a very hard time understanding why. You never want to argue somebody's experiences or their point of view or why they brought in certain things. I'm merely evaluating what has changed within the comic book in the adaptation as a feature film. Those elements don't work for me because the main crux of what is motivating our main characters would have been enough. I already mentioned the visual language of the film, and I think that would have worked more inherently in helping it be separated, but it was a confounding change that does increase the level of maturity likely required for entry. I'm very much considering not taking my kids to it just because of this inclusion. Without those elements, I would say this is mostly on par with what we got from Superman in terms of expected maturity for understanding the film. Of course, characters are going to die. This is a PG-13 film. And with that, you also have Lobo having to use his patented language. He does say Bastitch, which is something I was waiting for the entire movie from my main man, which was just fantastic. Lobo being in the movie and how he's woven into the main story is just for another one of the brigands, not Krem, which is funny. And the one that he's after, ironically, does look very similar to the comic book design of Krem, which is certainly a funny choice. The last major change, and something that I can see what the film is trying to do in its execution, but at the end of the day, I think it muddles the ultimate goal of what it's trying to say with this. We have many conversations in this film with Kara and Ruth about what revenge will do to you. And what's interesting about that is we know that Kara has had experiences since she left Krypton. We see glimpses of her on Earth, and then obviously she's in the midst of this bender. But the conversation she has with Ruth about the darkness that can come from vengeance sounds like it's coming from somebody who has committed some sort of heinous act, and that the murder of Krem wouldn't change her. It just feels more inherently built in. Kara does not want somebody else's trauma to define who they are. She's trying to help Ruth get past it and move on, which is understandable based on what we see Kara experience in this movie. And in the comic, Ruth desperately wants to kill Krem, and Kara prevents her from doing that and doesn't do it herself, leading to Krem not dying. Whether the change was done due to the fact that Krem is truly an evil person, incapable of redemption, and all of the evil things lead to a capital punishment. Kara is already so different than Clark. It would be confusing to me if this is an element of the story that doesn't move forward in Man of Tomorrow. Are they going to have a conversation about killing? We know that Superman won't in the DCU, and with Lex Luthor having to be an ally of Superman in Man of Tomorrow, is there going to be a conversation to the level of the argument of what is right and what is legally right between Lois and Clark, which is one of the best scenes of Superman? There has to be something in Man of Tomorrow that explores what this film has introduced with what Kara is willing to do for the greater good. We understand her motivation through the film, and one of the elements that I don't know if it was a complete coincidence is Kara's not in the suit for most of the movie, which we've seen her in other projects, of course, in Superman and in the brief cameo in Peacemaker. And while it may not be metaphorically in there as in she's being reborn as Supergirl, it simply could just be she's wearing a different outfit because it's her birthday. I like the symbolization of Kara becoming Supergirl at the end of the film when the yellow sun finally comes into horizon, as opposed to the green sun on Krem's planet. I mentioned in non-spoilers that this is the one real time we really get to play with the lighting of the film because of the two different suns, and Kara gets to be the full-fledged Supergirl that we know her to be. And I like the way that she fights. It's much more brawler, and she seems to be really thinking through what she's doing in a much more tactical way than Clark would ever do, which is funny because is this one of those instances where Clark learned for himself and then was able to teach Kara what she would have to do because he'd learned as a hero for however long he had been a hero when she shows up? So there's some muddying to the overall message at the end of the film, but I say this, as I said in the beginning, the selling point of this movie is Millie Alcock as Supergirl, and most of this movie works in delivering who this character is, why you should like her, and do you want to see more of her moving forward. I am annoyed that this film's reception seems to follow a pattern that unfortunately is the case in critical reception towards female-led superhero stories. There are many superhero films and comic book films that I would prefer not to watch in favor of Supergirl. The movie is under 2 hours in runtime. Allegedly, there was about 25 minutes cut from it. I would be very curious to seeing what that movie looks like being closer to the length of Superman. As somebody who did quite enjoy it, I want more of Millie Alcock as Supergirl. I think she absolutely nails what we want in this version of the character. She's clearly proven what she's capable of, being the lead of a film, and every instance of seeing her and Clark together is the springboard for Man of Tomorrow. This movie got me excited for the next movie, which unfortunately, as much as people don't want this to be part of the conversation, is kind of the goal of a shared universe. They don't necessarily have to directly lead one into another. Emotionally, where she is at the end of it, realizing she is now home with Clark on Earth by the end of the film, does set her in a much more optimistic place than she was at the beginning of the film, meaning that the journey of Supergirl served its purpose. We don't need it to be Brainiac being responsible for the death of Krypton, as much as that would have been really cool to lead into Man of Tomorrow. I am very curious to seeing how that does connect to the previous films, because it would be odd if it's just out of nowhere, or maybe the only linear connection through the three films will be Lex Luthor and his relationship with Krypto, as well as Clark and Kara's relationship with Krypto, because you know that's going to come up. That will do it for my full spoiler thoughts on Supergirl. Let me know in the comments, without ruining it for those who haven't, what you thought of the film. How many times did you see it? Did you take your kids? And all those fun things. Now let's move on to my favorite entertainment news of the week.
Tonight at 11.
Doom! We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
But that's not all, folks. Here's the real blockbuster. Brace yourselves. You might want to sit out.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
The first piece of news came out on June 23rd. Magic School Bus movie in the works at Legendary Pictures with Elizabeth Banks playing Miss Frizzle. I am obviously a child of the 90s. I love Magic School Bus. I think it really holds up. It's unfortunate that the new version that was on Netflix just didn't manage to capture the magic of the original series. There's something inherently special about Magic School Bus, as well as Bill Nye the Science Guy, where what you could classify as sort of edutainment managed to tell compelling stories and really be informative and get kids excited about science. Magic School Bus and Bill Nye the Science Guy are still used in schools today, and obviously Bill Nye has continued his career, letting us know why we're all screwed and the planet really does need our help. Elizabeth Banks as Miss Frizzle is perfect. I could think of other actors that may have had the opportunity to sort of fill that planet dress. That's a weird way of expressing that. Kate McKinnon actually voiced Miss Frizzle's sister, I believe, in the rebootquel that was on Netflix. But what we've seen from Elizabeth Banks almost feels like it was training for this film. Miss Frizzle needs to feel wacky, but super intelligent and sometimes completely out of control. And Elizabeth Banks has all of those qualities in her performances. Thinking of somebody, of course, like Effie Trinket. If you were Effie Trinket and then Miss Frizzle, those roles feel perfectly in line with what to expect from the character. What will be very interesting, because of course there have been many episodes of Magic School Bus, what is going to be the main plot of the film? Is it going to be space related? Is it going to be biologically connected? Is it going to be doing something meteorology related with the weather? There are so many different aspects of science that magic school bus explored. Another element, and unfortunately because of the world we live in now, there is going to be a criticism based on what the cast was of the original cartoon that was incredibly diverse for the era. Growing up in the 90s, we had substantially diverse casts. Now, they would just be ripped apart for being DEI and woke, but they were representative of the multiple student body that you would have. You had so many different cultures represented with all of the students. I'm hoping that that is still the case because that is just as important as the casting of Miss Frizzle. So you need really great child stars. I'm assuming they're all going to be unknowns because a majority of the budget is going to have to go to the special effects. We need a short bus. We need a very good animal CGI recreation with Liz. But I'm excited about this. This is something that, being a millennial myself, I've shown my kids this. I've shown students this. What are we going to get from a Magic School Bus movie? What is a theatrical adventure with Miss Frizzle going to be like? So many things have been adapted multiple times, and Magic School Bus is one of those franchises that really hasn't been done that much, and it continues to hold up to this day. I'm on board for this. I'm very curious who the director is going to be as well as the writer, but I'm on board for a Magic School Bus movie. Another film we are getting from Warner Brothers is interesting. Obviously, I thoroughly enjoyed Masters of the Universe, and I expressed my love of Masters of the Universe Revelation and Revolution, the two Kevin Smith Netflix series that unfortunately will no longer continue, because again, when we tell interesting stories with characters that aren't just He-Man, grown men from the Gen X era get really mad. Warner Brothers is making a reboot of Thundercats. Thundercats is incredibly interesting just as a world, because obviously they are cat people. If you are a film fan at all, you are aware of how hard Cats the Musical bombed so famously. And it is one of the most, I wouldn't say popular, but pop culture aware musicals, because it's always been awful. You are going to have to make a substantial amount of anthropomorphic cat people. You're not going to want to spend the budget that something like Cats required. So you're going to lean into more an animated property. And I'm very curious to seeing what kind of style that they go with this. Thundercats is on a tier even lower than Masters of the Universe. They tried to bring it back in 2011, and I know I mentioned this in my Masters of the Universe review, and that cartoon was fantastic. Unfortunately, it was in an era when you purely had to be selling toys in order to justify the existence of the television series. It ran for one season of 26 episodes, Will Friedle was Lion-O, and it was about the origins of the team. It was a great show, and made me like Thundercats. These 80s shows that didn't hold up, that were purely toy ads, not all of them have stood the test of time. It's been very rare that even something like Transformers, which sort of cyclically gets rebooted every now and then. I liked Beast Wars, I liked Generation 1, I like Transformers Prime. Unfortunately, we haven't had that many good Transformers movies, but animation is definitely a safer bet and risk just based on what the movie likely will cost. I would love, and I, you know, they say steal from the best if you're going to be inspired in quotes, if this sort of looked like what we got from Puss in Boots: The Last Wish, which obviously aesthetically is very different than what we're getting for Shrek 5. Just something that is just as visually captivating, and you need to manage to make the action really incredible. Make sure that those scenes are choreographed in a really interesting and compelling way that draws people to watching it. Make a trailer that sells Mumra as a really scary villain. That's incredibly important because there's so many people who are unaware and don't care about these franchises. You can't just make something generic, and I'm not saying that MOTU was. But these brands that just aren't in the upper echelon of what people are familiar with, they've got to work a little bit harder. And I'm not saying that that's fair, but that's definitely going to have to be the case with something like Thundercats. Warner Brothers is also working on another animated property that is reviving the Powerpuff Girls. There have been multiple chances in bringing this back. There even was a failed CW pilot back in the day, and this is an iconic franchise. It is so hilarious, the world that exists within the Powerpuff Girls. They had, I don't believe it was a theatrical feature film, but there certainly was a feature-length film that might have directly gone to home video. It's had multiple series, and it's a show that people are very familiar with. It ran for 6 seasons, which is not something that I had remembered until looking it up to talk about it today. But those characters are iconic. They are, I would say, in the younger generation. My sister was a fan of this show. She didn't watch the 2016 version. She watched the original early 2000s version. And this show created so many iconic characters. Mojo Jojo and all the other major characters from it. Oh, it was theatrically released. I'm looking that up right now. But yes, what are you going to get from these characters? How are we going to talk about it? It's ironic because obviously they are created by the professor, Utonium, but they are a blended family. They are adopted. They're not his own children. Are we going to change the origins of this? I hope, if anything, you need it to have the Powerpuff Girls and Mojo Jojo. He is their most iconic villain. He is their Joker. And he's the most connected to their lives. Quite literally was a chimpanzee that lived with the professor. And because of Chemical X, became who he became. The ultimate villain of the Powerpuff Girls. He even created, I believe they're called the Roddy Ruff Boys. I'm maybe misremembering what they're called. But the anti-Powerpuff Girls. Rowdy Ruff Boys. Who are their evil doppelgangers, and that would be super cool. They don't need to be the main antagonist, but you can wrap in a lot of the Powerpuff Girls lore just in a feature film. You have the benefit of time, which I'm on board for. I think the Powerpuff Girls are awesome. Similar to other things within the early 2000s, you could sort of equate different personality types. Blossom, Buttercup, and Bubbles are obviously so distinct from each other. But this is something that I think is really cool. There are certain brands that don't get brought up as much. This is obviously an early 2000s brand or late 90s brand, not like the last thing I just talked about, but it'll be interesting to seeing what they dive into with this. I think it's fun that we're getting more animated films because this is a genre that I absolutely adore, and animation needs to get more respect because it, quite frankly, doesn't get enough. That will do it for the news and entertainment of the entertainment news of the week. Now let's get to listener mail and question of the week responses.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
There's something I really need to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
Last week's question of the week was, what DC character would you like to see featured in a feature film in the DCU next? Jermaine Jones writes in, the character that I would like to see get a DCU film next, as in after Man of Tomorrow, is Diana Prince, as she is the fourth most iconic superhero. Now, what I like in the DCU to get her own movie, or his own movie, is Sportsmaster. Haha, that's a joke. Even though he raises 2 amazing daughters, that's true. Please watch Young Justice. If you know, you know. But the real answer would actually be Vandal Savage, to see how he became the first metahuman and being eternal to what has become throughout history. That movie would only be one word, Savage. Jermaine, what I like most about this suggestion, and I'm going to completely ignore Wonder Woman as the answer, is what's been interesting about what we've gotten so far from the DCU is things, for the most part, that have been happening as we've experienced them. Outside of Supergirl, which obviously had some flashback moments, it has been adventures as they are happening in the present. Vandal Savage would be a really great character because he would directly tie into the history of what we know from the DCU. I mentioned this in my spoiler thoughts. We knew that 3,000 years ago, the first metahuman appeared. What did Vandal Savage look like in the DC universe? Who did he go up against? Was it the JSA? If you could wrap in Vandal Savage and maybe a JSA story, that is something that I would be on board for, because the golden era superheroes, outside of Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, they just don't get as much love, and we know they existed based on the banner that is in the Justice Gang's headquarters. that's how I would like to wrap that up. You could have it be a movie that focuses on Vandal Savage, but introduces legacy characters, because we do know that Booster Gold is going to be coming up, as well as Blue Beetle, who was played by Xolo Maridueña in Blue Beetle. James Gunn himself has said he's going to be brought in. Ted Kord has a relationship with Booster Gold. I would like to sort of see how this stuff is interconnected. That would be really cool. And it's fun to explore the history of a shared universe when you think those things through. Scotty Cameron, the low-hanging fruits are Batman and Wonder Woman, especially Batman, so we can lay to rest the shoehorning of Pattinson into the DCU and maybe get a better Batman than Pattinson. Pattinson's great, however, we can never rule out the potential of getting someone who plays the role even better. I think that's a really healthy perspective. I was very concerned about that for a minute, Scotty. So my answer will be Captain Atom. I've always loved that he is Captain America-esque personality with the powers to absorb radiation and weaponizes it. Scotty, what I like about this answer is it's similar to what Jermaine said about Vandal Savage. I have enjoyed the Superman saga. I'm super excited for Lanterns as well as Clayface. They're going to be different parts of the DC universe. And with somebody like Captain Atom, you can have a story in line from a morality standpoint that is similar to something like Captain America. Somebody who has powers, who serves the US government, and maybe because of what they order him to do, goes rogue and does what he wants, what he feels is the righteous and just choice, making him a hero outside of just a soldier. That would be really great, because we know how the military and the government are always trying to be involved with what's going on. We saw that in Superman and Peacemaker. Is this somebody who has to do with the Savage Lands? Or is this a character who's created because of Superman and leads more into the connective tissue where we had Bizarro and Superman? But any way to expand this universe, that's something that I'm on board for. So I think that would be really cool. Dylan Pollock writes in, from DC, I'd love to see a Flash movie, or Martian Manhunter would be cool. Obviously, we're all waiting for Batman, but we're going to get Batman Part 2 coming, so I wouldn't mind other leaguers getting some love. I think the biggest mistake of the Flash movie is Flashpoint, because so many people have talked about how that is not the story to start with. You can talk about the murder of Nora Allen. Iris is Barry's wife, but actually showing the Flash going up against a speedster just visually would have been absolutely incredible. It's annoying that that's the case. They had to create their own version, and the previous Flash movie didn't even reference or mention the Reverse Flash or Professor Zoom. Yes, obviously we had 9 seasons of the television series, but I've brought this up on DC Studios. Barry Allen and Wally West sort of feel like they've been amalgamated in major media. I love the Young Justice separation of those characters, because we have Barry Allen as obviously the Justice League member, and then we had Wally West, who was very different than Barry Allen. I would like to see the Barry Allen, at least, that I feel like I know from the comics, and that's not shot at Grant Gustin. I thought he was great. He was in the role of the Flash for 10 years. That is something so important in defining people's expectations of that character. And it's not a criticism of what he was asked to do. That's the version of the character that he was asked to present to audiences for 10 years. And he did that very, very well. Martian Manhunter is another example of how you could, because of what we've heard they want to do, explore different tones. I obviously reviewed Spider-Man Noir. And I loved how it was so tonally different than everything we've had before. Martian Manhunter, John Jones, has been a private eye. What does that look like? Do we get to see maybe a story from the 50s? You can wrap that into the alien paranoia, the Red State, what was going on with the Russians, the fear of the Soviet Union, an actual alien, the fear of what aliens were in cinema at the time. That would be incredible. And again, it fills out the universe. Where has he been? You can tell us And eventually we know we're going to be getting the Justice League, so why not fill out the story with things that aren't specifically connected to what is happening in the present, which is pretty much what Man of Tomorrow is going to do. Thank you to everybody who submitted their answers for the question of the week, and now on to this week's question of the week. Next week's review is going to be of Minions and Monsters, and I can hear listeners groaning already in their headphones. Obviously, this is not necessarily the thing I want to be reviewing, but it is the feature film that will be out next week. So my question is, who is your favorite movie or TV henchman / minion? To let me know, you can comment below on YouTube and Spotify. You can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com, or you can @filmrealist on any of the social medias. Just make sure to include the hashtag QOTW. If you're watching the podcast on YouTube, please like the video and subscribe to the channel so you do not miss any episodes, and it helps the YouTube podcast get into more people's algorithms, which is always appreciated. If you're listening to this podcast on a podcast platform, please consider giving it 5 stars and following so you don't miss an episode. You don't want to do that. You loved listening to me talk about Supergirl, and you want to hear what I'm going to say about Minions 3. July is jam-packed. We have Minions 3, live-action Moana, The Odyssey, and then Star Trek Strange New Worlds Season 4. There's a lot coming out in July, and I really hope you want to hear me talk about the biggest movies and the biggest TV shows of the month, of the year. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Kyle Naranya, and I will see you next time.